Welcome to the Western Magazine Hour, stories and articles about the American West, produced at the Recording Library of West Texas. Your narrator is Jack.
Hi, this is Jack. I'm reading articles from Cowboys and Indians magazine. Rodeo Superman, Trevor Brazil. Since he stopped living on the road and in the dust, rodeo roper hero Trevor Brazil has settled into a horse-centered life in the longtime cowboy town of Decatur in rodeo-friendly Wise County, Texas. Trevor Brazil sits high on his horse with rope in hand on a billboard on the outskirts of Decatur, a historic Friday Night Lights town in North Texas known for rodeo legends. Brazil is one of them. A team, tie down, and steer roper, he's won more world championship belt buckles than any other cowboy in history. He's been called rodeo's answer to Superman. A multiple rodeo Hall of Famer, he's bagged 26 PRCA world titles, which is indicated in bold lettering on the billboard on the outskirts of town, and 14 all-around cowboy world championship titles. The billboard advertises a museum dedicated to him and another local rodeo Hall of Fame legend, Roy Super Looper Cooper, at the popular NRS, National Ropers Supply, an all things Western destination store just off U.S. Route 287 on the south side of town. Brazil makes his home in Decatur with his wife Shada, Cooper's stepdaughter, herself a world-class barrel racer who's also from Decatur, and their three children on a 100-acre ranch here where they breed American quarter horses. Born in Amarillo in the Texas Panhandle, about 300 miles to the northwest of here, Brazil's been around Decatur for most of his adult life. His father moved to Decatur in 93. 10 years later, Brazil bought a ranch there. He's made appearances in the local newspaper, the Wise County Messenger, but he's been making frequent appearances in national headlines around the country since he became a PRCA cowboy in 1996. His stepfather-in-law, an 8-time world roping champion, had been popping up in headlines when Brazil was still in diapers. He hails from a legendary rodeo family and mentored Brazil when he was coming up on the rodeo circuit in the late 80s and early 90s. At his prime, he, Brazil, had no competition. Joe Beaver, an 8-time NFR champion roper, and one of Roy's many traveling partners, told the Smithsonian Magazine in a 2018 profile of Brazil. He was so consistent. He was so fast and so darn good. He rarely made any mistakes. What he could do in the arena was unreal. He's probably the greatest roper that has ever been. In Wise County, he's just one of several rodeo champions who have been called this North Texas county of about 78,000 people home. World champion Gus Pickett, cowboy Alvin Baker, a well-known rodeo announcer and performer, and Dan Webb, a Texas Rodeo Cowboy Hall of Famer who won his first all-around cowboy saddle in 1972, were born and raised in the area. Others, like Brazil and Jose Vitor LeMay, a Brazilian bull rider considered one of the best riders today, got there as fast as they could. In fact, some of the best Brazilian bull riders in the world call Wise County home, from the 3-time world champion Silvano Alves to the Salgado brothers, Adriano and Taigo, and rising star Amandu Campos Silva, who at 22 tragically lost his life in a freak bull riding accident in August of 2021. Many locals aren't quite sure how the Brazilian bull riders ended up in Wise County. Brazilian bull rider Paulo Crimbor had no specific answer to give a WFAA reporter when asked how they ended up here in November 15, 2021 profile. "When I stepped foot here, I knew this is where I wanted to live for the rest of my life," he told the reporter. The draw to the area, says Farida Lassiter from the Visitor Center in Decatur, the county seat of Wise County, has to do with the county's cowboy heritage and focus on the Western lifestyle. Wise County has been hosting rodeos nearly as long as the Messenger has been publishing newspapers, 143 years. NRS Ranch is another draw to the area, according to Donna Whedon from the Wise County Historical Society, because of its professional rodeo arena and ability to draw some of the top rodeo contenders. Wise County Judge J.D. Clark agrees with Whedon. "The NRS is a huge magnet," he says. "Per capita," Clark points out, "we got a lot more world champions." It's an observation that Brazil shared with CNI in 2015. As far as concentrated professional cowboys go in Wise County, I would argue that we're rapidly becoming the cowboy capital of Texas. Nearly 8 years later, it's a claim Brazil stands behind and offers several reasons why, from a great rehabilitation facility for rodeo athletes at Fit and Wise, an affiliate of Wise Health System, in Decatur, to the Outlaw Equine Hospital and Rehab Center, which he points out offers a freestyle water walker, cold salt chambers, and swimming pools for horses, not to mention the biggest Western store you can have with everything Western you can want to wear. But it's the great ground for horses that drew Brazil back to the Decatur area nearly 20 years ago to make its home. "It's a sandy loam soil," Brazil says. "It's a good soil here, and that's really important when you're raising and training horses." Texas legend credits a group of cowboys drinking at Red Newell's Saloon in the cattle-driving southwest Texas town of Pecos with hosting the first official rodeo in the Lone Star State. They were unwinding after a hard day of work wrangling cattle when their conversation veered toward who was the better steer roper and bronc rider. One early July day, the cowboys proposed holding a rodeo to prove who was the better wrangler. It was an unheard-of proposal, since rodeos were usually held in the spring on ranches to brand cattle and claim the calves of the season. American Indian and Mexican vaqueros began wrangling cattle this way in the 1700s, going from ranch to ranch to do so. The rodeos would often last for a week or longer, the Messenger reported on June 29, 1894. Cowboys rodeo took place on July 4th. Some ranchers pitched in the $40 prize money for the cowboy who proved his claim. Texans came from miles around to see what may or may not have been the first official rodeo, depending on which old Western town you ask. According to the Texas Escapes website, several places claim to have held the first official rodeo, including Canadian, Texas, Peyton and Prescott, Arizona, and Deer Trail, Colorado. No matter where the first official rodeo occurred, it began to catch on, and rodeos began appearing in communities around Texas and as far away as New York, and eventually Europe. Wise County cowboys such as a steer roper Gus Pickett, the son of a Texas state representative and Confederate hero from Decatur, and Boyd native cowboy Alvin Baker, a world champion bronc rider, were making headlines for their rodeo skills and drawing thousands of fans to arenas. In 1899, a year after Cowboy Baker's birth, the St. Louis Fair Association held a world championship rodeo. Pickett won the world title, and nearly 20 years later, according to the Wise County Historical Society, organized the first official rodeo in Wise County at the Old Settlers Reunion, an annual event honoring old settlers and Confederate veterans like Pickett's father on the outskirts of Decatur. Pickett garnered the title of Top Cowboy in a Colorful Era from the Messenger shortly after he won the world championship in the late 1800s for steer roping. He had been competing in rodeos all around the country against rodeo cowboys such as Will Rogers, the legendary cowboy movie star, and building friendships with showman Buffalo Bill and Wild Bill Cody. Like Brazil, a century later, steer roping was a skill Pickett had been perfecting since he was a child on his father's ranch near Decatur. He spent most of his life there, cowboying for his family, before he moved on to the Dan Wagoner Ranch, where, according to the Messenger, he would become one of the last of the original cowboys to work the ranch. His father, George Bibb Pickett, became a Texas legend shortly after he returned home from the Civil War. A native of Kentucky, he moved to Wise County in 1854 and built his ranch near Decatur. He was an aggressive negotiator with the American Indians and would later take that skill into the political arena, where he'd win the offices of mayor, county judge, and representative in the Texas legislature. In 1876, he sponsored a bill to create the Texas Rangers to assist in subduing the Indians in the county. The Texas Historical Association reported in the Handbook of Texas Online. In Decatur, the elder Pickett focused on raising cattle on his ranch and ranch land in Jack and Young counties. The area was a gold mine for ranchers like the elder Pickett, with the nearby Chisholm Trail and the Fort Worth Stockyards a train stop away. His sons helped him on the ranch. Only Gus would take up the cowboy mantle. His brother Tom became a cattle rustler and rode out with outlaws Dave Rudabaugh and Billy the Kid before hanging up his guns to become a bartender, then a prospector, a cowhand, and later a deputy U.S. Marshal. Gus Pickett entered civil service like his father and eventually became the manager of the Wise County Fair and an organizer of the annual Old Settlers Reunion. In early October 1920, he organized a rodeo that would become an annual tradition for Wise County. More than 2,000 people descended on the rodeo arena on the outskirts of Decatur to watch the cowboys ride dusty, wild rodeo broncs and bulldog Mexican steers, the Messenger wrote in an October 8, 1920 report. Local favorite Little Gwen Williams, Jr., the son of a Decatur and Mineral Wells banker, dazzled the crowd with his rodeo skills. Like Texas' first rodeo, whether Pickett's rodeo was the first in Wise County is also up for debate. The history of Wise County, A Link with the Past, Volume 1, credits Dan Buck, a horseman from Wise County, with staging the first rodeo in a tent-covered arena for an admission fee. But it was mostly a bronc riding competition. Horses were his specialty, the author writes. He never used cattle at first. When Pickett died at the age of 82, the Messenger called him one of the last of the surviving cowboys in his October 8, 18, 1951 obituary. But he wasn't. It's a lifestyle that's alive and thriving in Wise County, especially as more rodeo professionals move into the area to raise their children in a place that, Clark says, values the small-town, rural way of life. Not to mention that makes sense logistically for rodeo professionals, according to Clark, with major highways 380 and 114 nearby, and the proximity to DFW Airport, without being in the city. We have a very strong rodeo tradition, says Clark. It's a tradition here, a culture here, a respect for the old ways. People support it and value it. On the outskirts of Decatur, NRS Ranch showcases this strong rodeo tradition and why people value and support it. Just off U.S. Route 287 South, the 90,000 square foot, 400 acre NRS World Headquarters appears on an open prairie, similar to where Pickett, Baker, Dunn, and Brazil perfected their rodeo skills. It's the super target of the Western lifestyle, with aisles upon aisles, 30,000 square feet of ranch gear and Western wear retail. The campus also includes a functioning round pen for equine demonstration, a full-service feed store, a 5,000 square foot hay barn, and a 7,000 square foot patio with a fire pit, fountain, and windmill. The new facility was completed in 2015, but tourists from all around the country have been visiting the store since it opened in 1989, buying memorabilia and marveling at the accomplishments of the two local rodeo cowboys honored in displays at the entrance to the gargantuan retail outlet. Brazil's display alone contains 26 world championship belt buckles in glass cases, his championship saddles engraved with team roper champion, steer roper champion, all-around cowboy champion, appear throughout the display, stacked from floor to ceiling, filling the area with a new leather smell. Framed magazine articles on the wall and his championship rides on a mounted large screen TV between his saddles proclaim his status as a multi-million dollar winner and a rodeo legend like Pickett, Baker, and Webb before him. Brazil was planning to build a trophy room, but figured if he built one of them, only his family and friends would be able to see his buckles and saddles. Displaying them at the NRS, he says, has been a great thing because more people can see his accomplishments and learn a little more about pro rodeo through that. I was just blessed not to have enough room for all of them, Brazil adds. Since retiring from full-time rodeo in 2018, Brazil has been continuing Wise County's rodeo tradition by inspiring young and old alike with his annual roping clinics at the NRS Roping Arena. Photographs of Brazil with his students also appear on the mounted TV, reaffirming why he's known as rodeo's Superman. Cooper's more modest display across the aisle includes his gold buckles, championship saddles, and lifetime of rodeo achievements. The elder Cooper's rodeo lineage appears on the wall in a sportscaster's diagram. His father, Dale Tuffy Cooper, an RCA cowboy and 1998 National Rodeo Hall of Fame inductee, appears atop the family tree. Eight-time world champion Roy Super Looper Cooper appears next, along with his accolades. 1983 prestigious Triple Crown champion, Pro Rodeo Hall of Fame, National Rodeo Hall of Fame, and Texas Rodeo Cowboy Hall of Fame. Cooper's sons appear under his name. Clint and Cliff have qualified several times for the Wrangler National Finals Rodeo. Their brother Tuff, who mentored under Brazil, has also qualified and won a world championship title four times. It's this family rodeo tradition that thrives in Wise County, and Brazil's family keeps that tradition alive by training young horses. Horses will always be a part of the Brazil's lives. I enjoy that part, Brazil says. I get to stay connected to the process of making good horses.
Hello, this is Michael, and I'm reading from True West Magazine, the March 2023 edition. The Godfather of Westerns by Henry C. Park. Robert Duvall talks about the iconic Lonesome Dove on the cusp of a special cast reunion. With 7 Emmys won, Lonesome Dove is unquestionably television's most respected Western achievement. The roles were so good. The nominations of Robert Duvall and Tommy Lee Jones as Best Actor and Diane Lane and Angelica Houston as Best Actress may have split the vote and canceled each other out. The miniseries had such a profound effect on the filmmakers and actors that many careers are now seen as pre-Lonesome Dove and post-Lonesome Dove. Jones had been a respected film and TV actor for nearly 2 decades, but Lonesome Dove made him a star. Lane's performance solidified her transition to adult roles, as was true for Ricky Schroeder, who went from teen heartthrob to leading man. With his Emmy won, Simon Windsor went from being an obscure director of Aussie TV episodes to perhaps the most in-demand Westerns director since John Ford. Duvall, on the other hand, was already a star, famous for his portrayal of Tom Hagen, the adopted son of Don Corleone in 1972's The Godfather and 1974's The Godfather Part II. Duvall had been nominated for Oscars in The Godfather, 1979's Apocalypse Now, and The Great Santini, and won the statue in 1983 for Tender Mercies. Millions of school kids knew him, and generations of them still do. As Boo Radley in 1962's To Kill a Mockingbird, he had hardly stepped before a TV camera in 20 years, but he knew this would be no ordinary miniseries. In fact, he says, "On Lonesome Dove, I walked into the dressing room and said, 'Boys, we're making the Godfather of Westerns.'" He spoke to True West from his home in Virginia on January 5th, 2016, his 85th birthday. True West, do you feel that Gus McRae in Lonesome Dove was the best role you ever had? Robert Duvall, probably. There are other parts I liked. I played a Cuban barber in 1993's Wrestling Ernest Hemingway with Richard Harris, which was one of my favorite parts. Man, I worked on that accent. Another one of my performances I liked was when I played Stalin in 1992's Stalin. I try to do different things. But I would say Lonesome Dove was like my Hamlet or my Henry V, so to speak. When it was over, I felt like I could retire. I felt like I'd done something fully and completely. He was a very complex guy. He said, "We killed off all the people that were interesting." That was years ago, but it was a fine character to be able to play. How much are you like Gus McRae? McMurtry still thinks we, Tommy Lee Jones and I, should have switched parts, and I totally disagree with the guy. Way back, my second wife, and I thank her eternally for this, said, "I read a book I like better maybe than Dostoevsky's Lonesome Dove," she said. "They're going to offer you the other part, but you have to play Augustus McRae because it's the most like you." You always try to find in yourself what the character calls for. They had offered the part to James Garner. I said to my agent, "If you can get him to change parts, I'll do it." He called back 4 hours later, said, "Garner's got a bad back. He can't go horseback for 16 weeks. I said, "Now, go after that part." It was so well written, the adaptation by William Whitliff. It was something that just drew me along. I was riding a lot of horses then, so I was very comfortable. I felt ready when we went. I had a little leverage. I wish I'd had more. They asked, "Who do you want for call?" I said, "Tommy Lee Jones." We had a true Comanche Indian play Blue Duck, but they wouldn't go for that. We went to Jones's ranch in San Saba. We herded cattle, riding Argentine polo saddles. He was a very open guy. I'm told you designed the Gus McRae hat, they insisted, some of the powers that be, that I wear a Mexican sombrero to play Gus. I said, I will not play the part if that's the case. I had to go to the producers. I showed them pictures of Texas Rangers on the border, and they all wore the kind of hats I wore in the movie. I said, let me pick my own hat, which finally they allowed. How did starring in Lonesome Dove affect your career? It's a lot like when I got an Oscar for 1983's Tender Mercies. A lot more recognition in airports. Wherever I go, people refer to that. When I was made an honorary Texas Ranger, a woman came up to me, Mr. Duvall, we watch this once a year. I wouldn't let my daughter's fiancé marry into the family until he had seen Lonesome Dove. In other places I go too, but especially in Texas, it's kind of a landmark for people. There are several events coming up celebrating roughly the 25th anniversary of Lonesome Dove. Finally, it's more like the 28th or 29th anniversary. I don't know why they waited so long, but they're going to finally do it in Fort Worth in the beginning of April. Will Danny Glover be there? I didn't see his name. Way back, I wanted Morgan Freeman for that part, but he wasn't well known that far back. What were the other actors like to work with? Diane Lane was fine, wonderful to work with, and Ricky Schroeder. It's interesting because her husband, I think they're divorced now, Josh Brolin, was up for the part of Newt, but he was a week late because Ricky Schroeder got it a week prior. Originally, we wanted Freddie Forrest for Robert Urich's role, but then Freddie ended up playing Blue Duck. Robert was very nice to work with. Angelica Houston was great to work with, and she had grown up riding horseback, riding on hunts with her father in Ireland. Did you have any doubts about a non-American director for your Western? No, Simon Winsor had done stuff. He came in well-prepared, and we went to work. And Doogie Milsom, the cinematographer, was terrific. He had done Full Metal Jacket. We had 16 weeks to work, and it was nice. It was concentrated. First, 10 days around Austin. Then down around Del Rio, Texas, near the border. Then up to New Mexico. Then up to Angel Fire Mountains, farther up in New Mexico, to suffice for Montana's Rockies, because we couldn't afford to go there. I was fortunate to be in, what I think I'm correct in saying, the two biggest film epics of the 20th century, The Godfather 1 and 2 and Lonesome Dove. Earlier in your career, you played villain Ned Pepper in True Grit, working with two legends, director Henry Hathaway and John Wayne. Henry Hathaway, we won't talk about him, but we'll talk about John Wayne, definitely. He was a wonderful man, good actor, good guy, so good in The Shootist at the end of his career. Back to Hathaway, I don't want to badmouth him, but he's the guy who said, when I say action, tense up, goddammit. There's a difference between intensity and tenseness. I didn't enjoy working with him, and I didn't think he treated Kim Darby so well. You played Jesse James in the Great Northfield, Minnesota Raid. Right. I said, let's get Gene Hackman to play my brother, Frank. They said he wasn't well known enough back then. Now he's retired. Retired? Jesus, it's funny. How does playing villains compare with heroes? You try to find the human being in yourself that will parallel what the script calls for. I call it the journey from ink to behavior. You find the behavior that the character calls for. I always try to find the contradictions. Even when I played Stalin, I tried to find the contradictions, some kind of vulnerability in the guy, whoever it is. I could find it with Gus McRae because he was a romantic anyway. What does the American West mean to you? It's an elusive thing. Like, when you go to England or wherever, they want to know about the West. That thing of pushing forward, pushing outward, the frontier. What's your next project? I'm trying to get two Elmer Kelton things that have fallen through. Can't get them done. Netflix, or anybody. You know, they can be Westerns, but you have to find the human thing in them, aside from horses and hats and spurs and Indian fighting. You have to find the humanness in the characters, for good and for bad. I think the Western kind of defines us. The English have Shakespeare, the French, Molière, the Russians have Chekhov, but the Western is ours, from Canada down. Hello, this is Michael. I'm reading from True West Magazine, April 2023 edition. Two Road Together by Johnny D. Boggs. Oliver Loving and Charles Goodnight made history in 1866, and 120 years later, Larry McMurtry made them legends. The Goodnight Loving Trail has inspired songwriters and novelists. Cattleman Charles Goodnight became one of the iconic figures of Texas and the West, and helped save the American bison from extinction. Oliver Loving, whose death in 1867 led to one of Robert Duvall's most endearing acting roles, has a Texas county and an Eddy County, New Mexico village named after him. Goodnight and Loving are credited with blazing the trail to deliver cattle to the Bosque Redondo Reservation at Fort Sumner in New Mexico Territory in 1866, and the trail eventually stretched to Denver and Cheyenne. The trace that led from Texas to Fort Sumner is generally known as the Goodnight Trail, while that which Goodnight later blazed direct to Cheyenne is called the Goodnight and Loving Trail, though sometimes the terms are used interchangeably, says J. Evetts Haley, who wrote in Charles Goodnight, Cowman and Plainsman, Houghton Mifflin, 1936. At least that's the legend. Two historians, however, have recently suggested that maybe the trail should be known as the Chisholm Trail. Chisholm versus Goodnight and Loving. Erroneous popular mythology holds that Charles Goodnight and Oliver Loving made the first drives across West Texas and up the Pecos River to New Mexico markets in 1866 and 1867. James Bailey Blackshear and Glenn Sample Ely argued in Confederates and Comanches, Skullduggery and Double Dealing in the Texas-New Mexico Borderlands, University of Oklahoma Press, 2021. In fact, this route was established prior to Goodnight and Loving and was known as the Chisholm Trail decades before Goodnight's biographer branded it the Goodnight Loving Trail. The authors partially based that argument on an 1897 civil engineer's map that labels the cattle route leading from the Concho River watershed to Horsehead Crossing on the Pecos River as the Chisholm Trail. Doing a scan on newspapers.com and newspaperarchive.com, granted, isn't sound scholarly research, but the earliest findings of Chisholm Trail, not including misspellings of the famed Texas to Kansas Chisholm Trail, that I found is 1884. Goodnight Trail, 1885, and Goodnight Loving Trail, 1923. Chisholm moved his Texas cattle operations to New Mexico in the late 1860s, basically following much of the Goodnight Loving route. The Goodnight Trail was called for the man who opened it and drove cattle over it for years, Charles Goodnight, the Galveston, Texas Daily News reported on November 25, 1892. It started in the country southeast, actually southwest, of Fort Worth, and led southwestward to the Pecos, which it crossed at Horsehead Crossing, followed the river up through New Mexico, and went over into Colorado, ending near Pueblo. West from Texas. With the establishment in 1863 of the million-acre reservation near Fort Sumner, beef was noted at that remote outpost in present-day Dabaca County before 1866. The Santa Fe Gazette ran a notice from the Army's Department of New Mexico's chief commissary seeking delivery of good marketable beef cattle to be delivered to Fort Sumner, 200 by May 31, 1864, 300 by June 30, 1864, and 500 by July 31, 1864. By then, Chisholm was tired of selling beef to the Confederacy. Born in 1824 in Tennessee, Chisholm had moved to Texas by 1837, where he worked in Paris as a store clerk. After stints as owner of grocery stores and in politics, Lamar County Clerk, 1852 to 54, Chisholm turned to ranching in North Texas, where he lived in Bolivar, near present-day Sanger, from 1856 to 62. When the Civil War broke out, he was placed in charge of getting herds to the Confederate Army along the Mississippi River. Chisholm later moved his operations to the Colorado River County east of present-day San Angelo, and also ran a store in Trickham, which became a point on the Western Cattle Trail. After the fall of Vicksburg, Mississippi in 1863, Chisholm learned that selling beef to the Confederacy was a money-losing enterprise. By 1864, a Confederate dollar was worth a dime. Union contractors, Blackshear and Ely wrote, paid in a currency that actually had value. Enter Union operators James Patterson, William C. Franks, Thomas L. Roberts, and James Conwell. They rode into Texas, and with Chisholm's help, gathered a herd of Confederate cattle and moved them into New Mexico Territory in the spring of 1865. Patterson and his associates weren't alone. Other Unionists managed to slip Texas beef into Mexico by loosely following John Butterfield's Overland Mail Company route, September 16, 1858, to March 21, 1861. Chisholm soon had a New Mexico connection, relocated there, and Blackshear and Ely wrote, West Texas cowmen were calling this Texas-New Mexico cattle road the Chisholm Trail. Not that it matters, because in 1866, Goodnight and Loving teamed up to make history and legend. A legendary partnership. Goodnight was born in Illinois in 1836, and his family moved to Texas when Goodnight was 9, 4 years after his father's death. At age 11, Goodnight started hiring out to farms. He tried other jobs, and in 1856, 3 years after his mother remarried, Goodnight partnered with his stepbrother, John Sheik, in the cattle business. In 1857, Goodnight and Sheik moved their cattle operation to Palo Pinto County. Loving, a Kentucky native who moved to Texas in 1843 when he was 30, had driven herds up the Shawnee Trail, and in 1860, he partnered with John Dawson to bring 1,500 cattle to Denver. Commissioned to drive cattle to Confederate forces on the Mississippi River later that year, Loving soon found himself in a situation similar to Chisholm's. The Confederate government reportedly owed Loving between $100,000 and $250,000 after the war. It was Goodnight's idea to take a herd to Bosque Redondo, and newspapers had spread word that there was a market for beef at Fort Sumner. The Office of Supervising Commissary announced that it sought bids for delivery of 6,000 cattle beginning July 1st for issue to the Indians on the Bosque Redondo Reservation. The cattle, the notice in March 22, 1866 edition of the Leavenworth, Kansas Daily Conservative read, must be weighed upon the scales at Fort Sumner or other point of delivery upon the reservation, under the personal supervision of the ACS at Fort Sumner, and his certificate of weights must accompany the accounts of the contractors when presented for payment. Goodnight could have asked Chisholm for advice. He was a great trail man, Goodnight said years later. No one had any advantage of him as an old-fashioned cowman, and he was the best counter that I ever knew. He could count three grades of cattle at once, and count them accurately, even if they were going at a trot. Goodnight did seek Loving's input. Loving warned Goodnight of the hardships on such a drive across dry country. Seeing that Goodnight was undeterred, the older cowman said, "If you will let me, I will go with you. I will not only let you, but it is the most desirable thing of my life," Goodnight replied. "I not only need the assistance of your force, but I need your advice." Their herds joined south of Belknap in present-day Newcastle, and on June 6, 1866, the drive of 2,000 cattle and 18 men, including former slave Bose Ickard, and one-armed Bill Wilson started west. Staying on the Butterfield route, men and livestock trod past Camp Cooper and Fort Phantom Hill and through Buffalo Gap near present-day Abilene, then pushed on toward Fort Chadburn and the Middle Concho River near present-day San Angelo, where they rested for what lay before them, the Staked Plains. Beating the odds. They moved through Castle Gap and 12 miles later reached the Pecos River at Horsehead Crossing and the country goodnight called the Graveyard of the Cowman's Hopes and the most desolate country that I had ever explored. Pushing north, they crossed the Pecos River at Pope's Crossing, not far from the New Mexico border. The crossing vanished with completion of the Red Bluff Dam and Reservoir in 1936. Immense numbers of cattle are now in this territory, and many more are en route from Texas, the Santa Fe New Mexican reported on July 21, 1866. We hear many rumors about the beef contract at the Bosque, and some who are not aware how things are managed in this country will be enlightened by the developments that will be made as soon as facts and figures can be gathered. Goodnight and Loving learned how things were managed when they reached Fort Sumner. Government contractors bought only steers, and the Texans had driven a mixed herd. You'd think that if indeed Goodnight sought out Chisholm's advice, old John would have mentioned the fact that Sumner was only a steer market. But maybe he did. Maybe Goodnight and Loving also had eyes on the Northern Plains. They sold the steers at Sumner for $12,000, and Goodnight returned to Texas, while Loving and his crew pushed the 700 to 800 remaining cattle to Denver. There, John W. Iliff, called the Cattle King of Colorado when he died in 1878, bought the herd. The Goodnight-Loving partnership was strong, so they drove another herd in 1867, taking the same route. Loving might have thought it was a good time to get out of Texas. A notice in the Dallas Herald said the Parker County Sheriff directed Loving to appear in district court in Weatherford in August after Robert E. Bell filed a petition against Loving and his son James, alleging that Bell was owed $1,432.92 for cattle that had been delivered in October 1866. Said amount is now due and unpaid, for which Bell praised judgment against said defendants for said debt and costs of suit. By the time that notice appeared in the press, however, Loving was dead. Riding ahead of the herd to initiate contract bidding at Sumner, Loving and Wilson were attacked by Indians in southern New Mexico. Loving was wounded, so he sent Wilson for help, which gave us Larry McMurtry's Lonesome Dove and made Duval the favorite trail boss and ex-Texas Ranger of many Americans. A group of Hispanic traders found the wounded Loving and brought him to Fort Sumner, where he died from gangrene on September 25th. Goodnight pushed the herd into Colorado, where he began a ranch and cattle relay station near Trinidad. In 1868, Goodnight returned to Fort Sumner, loaded Loving's coffin into a wagon, and brought him back to Texas for burial in Weatherford's Old City Greenwood Cemetery. Haley called this bit of legend the strangest and most touching funeral cavalcade in the history of the cow country. Bose Eckerd, who died in 1929 at age 85, is buried nearby, complete with Goodnight's praise. Served with me 4 years on the Goodnight Loving Trail, never shirked a duty or disobeyed an order, rode with me in many stampedes, participated in 3 engagements with Comanches, splendid behavior. North to Wyoming. Later in 1868, Goodnight contracted with Iliff to drive cattle to the Union Pacific Railroad in Cheyenne, Wyoming, extending the Goodnight Loving Trail again to Pueblo, east of Denver, to the South Platte River, past Greeley, and then along Crow Creek to Cheyenne. To save the expenses of Uncle Dick Wooten's toll road and avoid rugged Raton Pass, Goodnight later moved the trail through Trinchera Pass, not far from Kaplan, New Mexico. But Goodnight and Loving and Chisholm weren't the only cattlemen who would follow their trail. By 1870, Haley wrote, the trail along the Goodnight and Loving Trail was well established, and the amount of money handled by its Western bankers was noted as enormous. In 1885, Kansas closed its borders to Texas cattle drives, and with ranges in Colorado and points north needing cattle, the trail became a popular route through Texas and New Mexico. Popular with Texans, anyway. Not necessarily non-Texans. The Northern New Mexico Association have pledged themselves to see that no cattle are trailed from Texas northward west of the old Goodnight Trail, the Galveston Daily News reported June 24, 1886, and will institute trespass proceedings against all herds found on the range of any of its members after today. Not that it mattered. The big die-up, that tragic winter of 1886-87, killed hundreds of thousands of cattle, especially on the northern ranges. After that, lower railroad shipping rates and more efficient range management took over. Long cattle drives and trails like the Goodnight Loving, Goodnight, Chisholm, or whatever you want to call it, became a part of Western legend and history. In 1985, Texas author Larry McMurtry published his 11th novel and 12th book, Lonesome Dove. Nearly four decades later, the Pulitzer Prize-winning bestseller is considered one of the greatest and most popular American novels of all time. What many may not remember is that it was also a major turning point in McMurtry's life and writing career. Up to that year, the Archer City, Texas native was best known as a novelist of the 20th century West. Like his Western peers Max Evans, Jim Harrison, Ivan Doig, Thomas McGuane, and J.P.S. Brown, he mined his own experiences in life to write about the West he knew and loved. He also found fame as a screenwriter and competed for national headlines in Hollywood and New York with contemporaries Tom Wolfe, Pat Conroy, and Ken Kesey. He had transcended the label Western writer until he wrote Lonesome Dove, his first 19th century Western novel. And while an 843-page novel cannot be considered a whim, McMurtry himself never considered it as great an American novel as it is. He was even quoted as saying, it was the Gone with the Wind of the West, which is good and bad. I would challenge McMurtry's modesty and suggest that in the pantheon of American literature, Lonesome Dove should be side by side with James Fenimore Cooper's The Last of the Mohicans, Mark Twain's Huckleberry Finn, Wyla Cather's O Pioneers, Edna Ferber's Cimarron, John Steinbeck's Grapes of Wrath, Wallace Stegner's Angle of Repose, and, of course, Margaret Mitchell's Gone with the Wind by Stuart Rosebrook. True West Magazine, April 2023 edition. A Champion of the Small Ranchers by Mark Boardman. Nate Champion became a martyr in the Johnson County War. For some residents of Johnson County, Wyoming, in the 1890s, Nate Champion had the perfect name. He was a champion of the rights of small ranchers in the area. But for others, the cattle barons, he was nothing but a rustler who threatened their herds and profits. Champion was born in Texas in 1857, but later made his way to Wyoming. There, he was a cowboy and owned a small spread. By the early 1890s, he was leading efforts to organize the small ranchers in Johnson County. The aim? To conduct a roundup of unbranded cattle on the open range. The large ranchers claimed that all the cattle were theirs. Legal authorities tended to stay out of the argument, so the barons took matters into their own hands. Nate Champion was the first target on a list of men to be killed. The theory was that if they killed the leader of the small ranchers, then the organization would fall apart. The barons put together a mercenary army of about 50 men, many recruited from Texas. They made their way from Cheyenne to Champion's KC Ranch, not far from the town of Buffalo. On April 9, 1892, before dawn, the so-called invaders surrounded Champion's cabin. Two visitors came out first. They were captured and later released. Champion's partner, Nick Ray, came to the door to see what was going on. He was shot and mortally wounded. The army then opened up, firing indiscriminately at the home. Champion fought back, holding off the invaders for most of the day and keeping a running diary of the events. As darkness neared, the invaders set fire to the cabin. Champion ran out the back door, shooting as he went. He was hit an estimated 28 times and died near the building. The army then prepared to make its way to Buffalo, intending to capture the town which favored the small ranchers. It wasn't to be. A couple of passersby had seen the siege and spread the alarm. About 200 townsmen headed off the invaders at the TA Ranch, where the invaders were surrounded in a barn. An army unit managed to save them. They were arrested and taken to Buffalo to face murder charges. But the cattle barons used their money to delay legal proceedings that nearly bankrupted Johnson County. Charges were dropped. Nobody was ever tried in the death of Nate Champion. But in several ways, Champion was the victor. Democrat candidates across the state, most of whom supported the small ranchers, were overwhelmingly voted into office in the next election. The small ranchers gradually claimed and fenced off the open range lands, and Nate Champion's grave at Buffalo's Willow Grove Cemetery was and is something of a shrine to a man who stood up to the powers that be. True West Magazine, April 2023 edition. Crazy Horse, Preachers, and Horse Thieves by Marshall Trimble. Ask the Marshal. Was Crazy Horse part white? Ronnie Bishop, Tulsa, Oklahoma. Crazy Horse was born to parents from two different brands of the Lakota division of the Sioux, his father being an Oglala and his mother being a Minneconjou. Which, in your opinion, is the most historically correct movie or TV series? Suzanne Evans, San Antonio, Texas. The dress in Western films is much better today than it was during the period prior to the 1970s. Hollywood is much better at getting it right and using reenactors as extras. It's pretty hard to pick a best and worst, but for fiction, I like Lonesome Dove. I like any Western that stars Sam Elliott. They've never gotten the so-called gunfight at the OK Corral correct. In Tombstone, Virgil Earp was shot in the right arm. In real life, it was his left arm that was crippled. And they turned parts of the film into a spaghetti Western. I'm still looking for a historically accurate film on the gunfight near the OK Corral. Was stealing a horse a hanging offense? Bill Haynes, Tucson, Arizona. Not from a legal standpoint, but some horse thieves were lynched. Horses were valuable as transportation and integral parts of several occupations, so many people weren't willing to put up with the crime. What can you tell me about the legend of El Tiradito in Tucson? Vanessa Hughes, Tucson, Arizona. El Tiradito is located in Tucson's Barrio Viejo, and is supposed to be the world's only shrine for a sinner. One story is that in the 1870s, there was an ill-fated love affair between a young sheepherder named Juan Oliveras and his mother-in-law. His father-in-law came home from his sheep ranch early one day and caught the two in an amorous situation. The older man killed Juan. Since Juan was guilty of a sin, adultery, he couldn't be buried on consecrated ground, so he was buried on the site where he was slain. As time went by, the women of the barrio began to romanticize the affair and visited the site to light candles and pray that he be forgiven. Soon it became a shrine for parents concerned about their flirtatious daughters. The shrine is located on 400 South Main Avenue between Cushing and Simpson Streets, and is listed on the National Register of Historic Places. Did the pastors of churches in Old West towns do that as a full-time occupation, Or did they usually have to work other jobs to make it financially? Wesley Brown, Saginaw, Michigan. Many Methodist circuit riders who went from community to community on a regular route relied on the help of the individuals and congregations they served. But others, especially those who were married and settled down, found additional jobs to help make ends meet. Methodist Reverend James Harden served various places in North Texas, including the village of Dallas for a time. With his growing family, the pastor owned and ran a farm and a school. One of his sons found a different way to get by. Gunman John Wesley Harden. What was Billy the Kid's real name? David Mills, The Villages, Florida. The Kid's official birth name was William Henry McCarthy, Jr. His birthplace is not certain, although some say New York City. In 1873, his mother, Catherine McCarthy, married William Antron, and the family settled in Silver City, New Mexico. To avoid confusion with the two Williams and the family, she began calling the youngster by his middle name, Henry. Henry Antrim began using William H. Bonney as an alias after he shot and killed Frank Wendy Cahill during a fight in Arizona. The reason he chose Bonney is unknown, but some speculate it was because that was his biological father's name before his mother married a man named McCarthy.
Thank you for joining us for the Western Magazine Hour. Stories and articles about the American West. Your narrator has been Jack. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand with your computer or favorite mobile device at recordinglibrary.org.